Hi everyone, welcome to another episode of Standing on Points, the History and Culture of Punctuation. This is going to be the very long-awaited second part of the history of punctuation, a very potted history that yet is going to take quite a while. I realize I have a lot to go through, and if it all becomes too long, I might just cut off after the Renaissance, because lots of things happen in the Renaissance. It's really a boom for punctuation. So perhaps I will just cut it off and do a coda going right up until today. But really, not much is happening after the Renaissance in terms of actual invention. It's more like we just keep reusing what we already have in different ways. So perhaps that coda isn't even necessary. We will see. What is clear is that it's going to be very interesting, quite long, but really exciting stuff for punctuation and for sort of textual culture in general, and then also for literature, because of course Shakespeare falls right into that time of linguistic and literary sparkle, I guess. So I think the last time, in the first part of the history of punctuation, I left off at the Bible. At what Christianity does, sort of right up until the late-ish Middle Ages, just stopping before humanists in Italy start to reinvent Latin and how it's supposed to look like, the page is supposed to look like. So I just want to give a brief recap as a springboard. So punctuation, which includes, roughly speaking, a dot, comma, semicolon, colon, exclamation mark, quotation mark, and most of all also space, so blankness, a line between stanzas of a poem or a song, margins or indentation, and very, very much also the space between two words. Punctuation did not just appear from anywhere. We haven't been using it forever. It hasn't been invented while writing has been invented, or printing, or whatever. It is something that has grown across thousands of years historically in different languages, in different ways, in different literary or textual cultures in different ways. Different technologies give us different ways of writing or capturing text or speech, and hence also punctuation. So the earliest fragments of writing, except for, you know, engraving or cuneiform or hieroglyphs, but writing, I guess, on papyrus or paper, whatever one wants to call it, are just fragments. So it's a little bit hard to reconstruct that. But what scholars have found out or assume is that in classical antiquity, with the Romans and the Greeks, there was no such thing as punctuation as we know it today. So people would just write in one long line without even spaces between the words. So that kind of grew as time went on, and people wanted to be able to distinguish words better and make sense faster. So they would put dots at different levels of the line to say, here is a sentence finishing, and here's another starting, and here's the boundary of a word, and here is the boundary of a element of the sentence, so like a clause or or an expressive remark or something like that. And then at some point, spaces between the words appear, and And the layout starts to change, so there's more concern how to manipulate where to put text or words in order to make sense visually faster. For instance, lowercase and uppercase letters have been introduced or developed. All of these things to help people read faster, read in the blink of an eye, as it were, and to fix meaning, to disambiguate meaning, which is especially important if you think about the Bible, for instance, being the word of God, and heresy or heretical thought or maybe unorthodox thought or whatever might endanger your soul. So that is, I suppose, how we go into the later Middle Ages in terms of punctuation in the West. And this is where I think I left off. So this session, I will talk about sort of the late Middle Ages, 13th, 14th, 15th century, going into the Renaissance, where there's an explosion of punctuation, signs and thought about punctuation, and based on two big issues of the Renaissance, which are humanism and the interest in Latin and classical Latin, and the interest in how a page looks like, as well as the printing press. So an invention, a new technologies of writing and reading and spreading of the word. These two big cultural phenomena really impact on punctuation. And the other way around, one never knows, you know. That's sort of which came because of which. I mean, obviously punctuation doesn't cause the printing press, but I don't think necessarily that stories are very neat. So these are the two big things we are going to talk about that set us up for looking at the invention of certain marks. Why might they have been invented? Who was it? Or was it sort of a kind of cultural thing where you can't really place your finger anymore? Who does what? Interestingly, though, in the Renaissance, because you have these scholar printers, scholar thinkers, writers, they do actually invent whole new signs, which is just so fascinating because this has not happened since. So this is kind of how the episode's going to look like. And as I said, if we have time, we're going to go up right up until today and think a little bit about how it comes that we actually haven't been very inventive in terms of punctuation. It seems to serve us well what we have. So the late Middle Ages, sort of like 12th, 13th century, is a time where, this is all very roughly speaking, of course, and one can make mistakes in trying to portray it as something fixed. There's a lot of overlap between signs that are being used, and it's a patchy history because, you know, evidence is maybe scarce. But scholasticism was the kind of governed the zeitgeist, I suppose. And I mean, scholasticism is a super complicated philosophical phenomenon, which I really don't know very well. But in terms of language, from what I understand, scholasticism sort of does away with punctuation a little bit because it doesn't need it, because the scholastics write Latin in a formulaic way, which sort of looks back to very early classical times where, again, there was no need for punctuation as we know it today, because people would be so familiar with the way of expressing and with the rhythms of the language and with the rhythms how they ought to be and how they're beautiful. They would be able to realize that. So there's no need in a way to have a full stop and tell you when a sentence is finished, because by way of the rhythm of the sentence, you know that anyway. So scholasticism is maybe a little bit similar in terms of minimal punctuation and just marking where the boundaries of a sentence are. For example, a really sort of, I think, funny kind of punctuation story in a way is the invention of the introduction of a comma-like sign, which is called the virgula. So virgula, I think I talked about this in terms of the shape of punctuation. Virgula means wand, and Buon Compagno da Signa, a scholastic thinker of, I think, the 12th 11th or 12th century in Italy introduces the full stop, or the dot at the bottom of the line, for the end of a period, the end of a sentence, and for any medial pause, any sort of slight pause, without really distinguishing very much whether it's a longish medial pause or shorter, which kind of element of a sentence is it, without kind of going into detail, you just put a virgula, which is like a forward slash. And virgula, so that's called a virgula suspensiva. And that is when you have a medial pause. And then actually you don't have a dot, I made a mistake. You have a virgula plana. So that's a kind of dash that's dropped onto the line for a full stop. So one that's up and one that's down. And that obviously is very minimal, really. You just kind of, it just sort of notices when there's a pause, which might or might not coincide with a grammatical sort of caesura or a rhetorical caesura or whatever. But the funny sort of the joke in all of that is that virgula suspensiva, so the upwards, the forward slash, which is for the medial pause, means like the suspended wand or the erect or upright wand, and virgula was a Latin jargon for penis. So the erect penis is the medial pause, and when you still want to continue the sentence and continue your action, and then you have the virgula plana, the one that's flat on the ground, the tired one, when you're done with what you want to say or do. So really very, just very minimal. And the virgula is important because it's going to stay for a couple of hundred years, and it's going to become important when humanists try to distinguish their activity, as it were, from the Latin that has been happening before and from medieval thinkers and medieval practices that has come before. So we're going to come back to that. That's why I think I mentioned it again. The virgula, sort of like the comma, colon, semicolon, all of it mushed together, as it were. And then after this sort of scholastic, very focused and proof-based, logical, supposedly logical interest, there's a reaction to that by Latin writers or scholars or thinkers who call themselves the Ars Dictaminists. So, or the Dictaminists, which is based on Ars Dictaminis, which means the art of letter writing. So they were interested in how to write well and write beautifully, write elegant Latin, which I'm not a Latinist, but from what I understand, it stands in stark contrast to the scholastic or the medieval Latin, which is for use and for function. I suppose is really not that that much of a binary, but that's sort of the story, even if it's the story that they themselves tell. And the kind of interest in beautiful Latin and in the sense of the oral in writing in this epistolary letter writing culture is important because it sort of prepares or prepares the way or introduces us to humanist thought. And as I said, humanism and the printing press are two big things that need to be discussed, two big factors that impact and influence punctuation and just culture and life in general. So I'll try to give a not too simplifying overview. So humanism is not what we think of it today in terms of sort of human, putting human, the human center stage and being more concerned with secular life rather than religion or theocracy or something like that. No, humanism, which is not a term that they themselves would use, but is sort of a backward label, a label that we attach with hindsight, retrospectively, to that period or that activity. Humanism
is an interest is people we call people humanists or scholars humanists who had an interest in classical Latin. Sort of that sort of came up in the 14th, 15th centuries, going into the 16th and 17th century, starting from Italy, where manuscripts were being discovered in maybe very remote corners of a monastery or something like that. And these manuscripts went back way, way, way longer than what has been known and circulating before. So they were closer to the actual time of Cicero, of Quintilian, of Terence or whatever. And that Latin was evidently different from the Latin that came out after 1400 years. So that Latin is as it were, more closer to the original Latin, is perceived as being more stylish, more elegant, more balanced even. And so humanists like, for instance, Petrarch, Boccaccio, Coluccio Salutati, and then the next generation being Erasmus, for instance, Thomas More, those people were all interested in stylish Latin and kind of sort of clean Latin. And with that also comes an interest in the sentence. So not anymore just the boundaries of a sentence, where does one start and end, but what's inside that sentence? What are the constituent elements, grammatically speaking, rhetorically speaking, morphologically speaking? So how can I, as a writer, flag up to my reader what I'm doing and enhance the reader's experience of my beautiful rhythmical writing? How can I help them read quickly? How can I sort of make clear certain relationships in a sentence? Well, that is being done through punctuation. And it's not only the syntactical relationships, the grammatical relationships between sentences, but also between themes, sort of nugget themes in different parts of the sentence, and also then the sort of oratorical mindset coming out of that epistolary culture that thought of, well, this is my voice that I record here. I know it's writing, but it's sort of it has an oral quality. Then you need a more subtle pausing, more subtle structure, as it were. So humanists were interested in going into that sentence and making clear that their elegant Latin is being experienced as sort of intensely as possible, I suppose. So what humanists, the interest that they push forward is an interest in Latin and classical Latin, an elegance of writing, whatever that means. Formal structures, as it were, and evidently formal structures as well. And an interest in melody, I suppose, or prosody, you would rather say, for a sentence. And in subtle pausing within the sentence. And that really requires more punctuation than just a dot or a virgule, right? So Petrarch, who lived in the 14th century, was a Latin scholar. He also wrote in Italian, but he was thinking very much about his contribution to the world in terms of his Latin. And so his interest in punctuation is more sort of Latin-based, his writing in Latin. But it's interesting that he is actually aware of punctuation and he is writing. I don't think he wrote about it, but he had drafts of his own works, and he changed them from one year to the other, and he put in different kinds of marks of punctuation, and he also invented a mark, or he sort of fiddled with what there was, which didn't catch on though. So Petrarch was interested in telling his readers about ideas that he puts into the sentence. So that would be, today we would just put a bracket and we would say, well, this is just an interpolation, as it were. We would just, we have an idea, we have here a sentence, and then we just put another idea in, right? And today we would probably just do that with a comma or with a bracket or something. For Petrarch, he also marked this interpolation, this sort of insertion off with punctuation. But for him, there was a difference whether the idea in that insertion is more or less connected to what is around it, to the sentence that holds it, the environment, as it were. So, and he has two different signs. One of them, he is kind of invents, but not really. He uses the virgula, the virgule, with a little dot in the middle. So that's not really, I guess, a totally new invention. But he uses this virgula and another sign from the Middle Ages called punctus elevatus, which would go on to become the colon. He uses these two to signal an insertion, and he also wants to tell us what kind it is. How is it more or less connected or disconnected to what is around it? So that's a very subtle practice in terms of telling us about his own sentence and what's happening inside. This is, for instance, Petrarch. And some other signs that have been invented, and I'm coming back to them, but I just want to talk also about the printing press. But I will come back to these signs. So we have humanists, Petrarch, interest in Latin. Petrarch is a huge figure. Also in terms of love sonnets, and which is less concerned. I think his Italian writing is less concerned with punctuation. But in any case, a big, big, big influence. And around the same time, so just a little bit later, from Petrarch in the 15th century, somebody, Coluccio Salutati, invents the parentheses, the brackets. We're going to come back to that. He also revives the exclamation mark, the punctus admirativus. There's a revival of the question mark. In the later part of the 15th century, we have a new shape of the comma, not the virgule anymore, but the comma that we know today, and we have the semicolon. So really, within 100 years, you have, I don't know, 5 or 6 marks and revivals of marks for more subtle control and expression inside of the sentence. Right, but we will come back to these marks a little later on. So humanism, a huge influence in terms of style and language, and in terms of technology in the Renaissance, you have the printing press, incredibly impactful, unimaginable amount of influence that the printing press had on writing, thinking, the way that's been done, the way that people experienced that, the way that writers started thinking about text, scholars, the Reformation, the Counter-Reformation. So just unimaginable, probably like the internet, I suppose. There's loads of scholars that compare those two phenomena, the printing press in the West, that particular moment in time, because printing presses have been around before in China. And then the internet, our big kind of cultural revolution. Right, so in around 1450, the 1450s, Johannes Gutenberg, a printer in Mainz, realizes how to print with movable type. So that means there has been printing around before, but people would maybe cut words, whole words, as a block into wood and then use that for printing. And this was still, for instance, how wood cut, so the images, illustrations would still be happening, even in the 16th century, that you would cut an entire image into a piece of wood and would print from that. But what Gutenberg invents or develops is how to print with movable type. So you just have those letters that you put on a, I think it's called, printer stick, I think. Yeah, it's a sort of a thing to hold, like a handle, a stick, a case or something. And then the printer puts the letters for a word, an entire sentence, and of course also the blank spaces between the words, because they also need to be put, and prints from these. And then after being done, they undo the case and they kind of continue like that. And so that is a huge change from what there has been before. Why? Because you can be faster in the production of text. So you don't have to cut it into wood anymore. You don't have to write it out by hand. You just have those movable types. And I mean, people became quite fast in putting the text, and then also dismantling it afterwards. And so you can really increase the speed at which you can produce text. You can do quite a lot of them. So most of the time, I think almost the entirety of printing press times, let's say at least from 1500 onwards, 1500 copies were one print run. So you have a relatively high amount of text in one go. And most of all, you have a mostly identical looking text. Of course, when people were, you know, writers or printers themselves or whatever, were rereading the first trial pages, stuff changed. That is why we have different versions of essentially the same text. Now, for instance, of Spenser's The Fairy Queen or so, from 1593. 1590 is part 1 to 3. So we have different versions of the same text with very slight changes sometimes. Maybe a comma, maybe a letter, you know, O T O S E, an E that you don't hear and that doesn't do anything at a word, at the end of a word, that's just sort of a relic from a certain kind of pronunciation or medieval spelling or something like that. And sometimes these changes are a bit more substantial. However, those changes really didn't really change the text in significant ways. So you have a high number of texts done relatively quickly with not like a huge amount of money. The paper was the most expensive thing probably. And relatively identical. That is a huge change from what there was before, where you would have scriptoria, so scribes, professional people copying texts, sometimes even personal scriptoria of a rich merchant or man or something like that. Or you would do it yourself by hand, or you would have your secretary, or your wife would do it for you, or your daughters in the family household or something like that. But this was laborious work. It was slow. We know that when we copied poems as children, right? They were always individual, or at least most of the time, no single copy was just exactly like the other. But that changes utterly with the printing press. And this is also going to be important, because that means that the shape of a mark of punctuation, such as the comma, for example, like we know it today, that can really take over all the different kinds of versions there are when it is being used, if it's being used in a very authoritative text, such as, for example, by Erasmus. Everybody was reading Erasmus texts, and people got used to how it looked like, and people got used to how it was being used. Not really rules, but the custom, as it were, that happened to be in that text. So there was a standardization push happening through the printing press. The printing press was quite spread quite fast. So the first one was from 1450 in Mainz, in sort of the southern part of Germany, and then that went on within just 20 or 30 years to France, to Italy, finally one in England by Caxton in 1476 from the Low Countries. And by the end of the 15th century, so just really one generation, 50 years, there were printing presses in more than 250 European towns. So it really, really took over. It was, and it took over mostly not just for an elite caste, but for everyone. These books, or these pamphlets rather, that were being printed, that those texts, they were affordable. People were able to buy them. And, so that's also important to say, I suppose, is that at the beginning, that technology, that printing press, still was finding its feet, still was finding the way that it would do stuff. Just as today, with those of us who remember the early days of the internet, where you would have you know, maybe a cumbersome layout and the looks were, that nowadays are maybe imitated to make it look like 90s websites. But just as any technology, the printing press, printers were still, scholars were still trying to find out about the possibilities that inhered in it, that it offered them. Possibilities in terms of technology and visual stuff, as well as, I guess, more conceptual things. So, for example, what about the layout, and what can I do with the layout for my trilingual Bible publication, for instance. And so at the beginning, those early printed books still very much imitated the looks of manuscripts in terms of the script, for example, but also in terms of layout, in terms of what was in there, what was not in there. And but by the end of the 15th century, printers, who were very often also scholars themselves or were working together with scholars, had found their feet as well, had developed their own ways of doing things. For example, and this again, very much connected to humanism. For example, the master printer and scholar that I've mentioned before, Aldo Manutio or Aldus Manutius, he realized, because he was also a humanist, he wanted to make the page neater, more, less cluttered, as it were, with more margins for people to annotate the classical work, for example, and wanted to make it more readable, more, again, like the language themselves, what they considered classy and stylish, space, open, beautiful, round, but also uncluttered, as it were. Sleek, I suppose, and it really does make a big difference if you see a black letter text, which is sort of the native medievalish, dense, black, exactly, not very much space between the letters and the word and the kerning. It's called kerning when you have, for example, a letter like N, and the two legs of the N are quite close together. You know, if you're not used to it, it's kind of hard to read. If you're used to it, probably it's not very hard, but still, the looks, it has the look of being quite full or potentially cluttered. And then you have a page printed in Latin by Manutio in the 1490s, and there's a lot of space, there's nice clean margins, and most of all, there's a new kind of typeface, such as Roman and Italic. So some people use different terms, but I use the term type or typeface for something like Garamond, Calibri, Arial, Times New Roman. And then font or font size for the actual size, rather it's like a 0.12 or 0.16 or whatever. So what Aldus also does is to experiment with the script, with the typeface, as it were. And he supposedly goes back to a classical looking typeface, but that is actually probably Carolingian from the 9th century. But he thought that was sort of going back to Roman, which is why it's called Roman. And we sort of are used to that today. So if you would never ever have seen a 15th century, 16th century Latin or sort of humanist early printed page, you would still be able to realize, you would still be able to read it firstly, and it would not be unfamiliar to you because we still use Times New Roman, which essentially looks the same. And another invention was italics, so that's sort of cursive, slanted. That was, for example, invented by Aldus and the Aldine Press in Venice. And these things are important because, again, it sort of goes together with the invention of the printing press and the standardization of looks, because that also means a change in how punctuation marks look like and a standardization of punctuation marks, because punctuation was cut together with a certain set of typeface. So if you would be a printer in England and you buy a typeface from somewhere, you buy the entire set together with the punctuation that comes together, like today the keyboard as well. So we have a lot of different dynamics or forces that are moving together and that are being active in those 200 years, 15th and 16th century, when it comes to writing, when it comes to reading, and then also, of course, punctuation. Right. I just have to see how much time I've been talking, because I don't want to make this too super long, but I suppose if I wanted to go into sort of biographies of the different marks now, the person that stands out most really is Aldo Manuzio. Aldus Manutius is the scholar printer that I've mentioned so much, that was inventing the different typefaces and the different looks on the page, because he also invented one mark and he shaped the shape of another, which is that he cut the comma that we use today, or he chose that shape to replace the virgula. The virgule, as I said, the forward slash for Latin publication and for Roman and cursive or italics. And that is quite significant in terms of a cultural issue, I suppose, because although the comma was being used very quickly all over languages and cultures, and that also found its way into black letter, as I've said, the sort of medievalish, I suppose, manuscript-looking typeface that was being used for vernacular texts, so texts in English, German, and not Latin or Italian, for example. And the virgule kept being used as a replacement for the comma, sometimes even for the full stop, for a very long time in black letter, in print publications, and also in manuscript. So the comma did find its way into black letter, but it was never the other way around. You would never have in Latin text, such as a Caesar or whatever publication, Livius or something, with a virgule. It would always be the comma that we know today, the little hook that Aldus introduced in the late 15th century. So there's a definite, they make a very definite distinction between the shape of punctuation. The function might be the same, but that's like in your face, modern and stylish and all those connotations, and then in your face, maybe a bit more conservative, traditional, vernacular, kind of English native, whatever that means, right? So I find that so interesting because it's so particular and so attentive to detail, And I think this is actually still what we do, I think. And this is why I'm so interested in punctuation, because it allows us to stop. It allows us to think about something that we sort of consider as invisible and something that we don't really notice. But when you have two texts next to each other, for example, in the 1520s, there was an edition of Cicero and in Latin and the facing English translation. I can't remember quite what work of Cicero's it was. Maybe a letter written to somebody or so. But you had the Latin and you had the English on the other side in the 1520s, so quite early. And the English, of course, is in black letter and uses the virgule. And the Latin is in Roman and uses the comma that we know today. And when you have these two things, firstly, I think it really jumps into the eye much more. But again, you stop and you consider and you reflect and you realize just even how much work we actually do when we don't notice that we do that, and how many connotations are triggered subconsciously even in us when we see the virgule and when we see the comma. Even today that we are totally unused to this virgule forward slash kind of thing, we would be able to notice that. We would probably be able, with a little bit of background knowledge, to make sense of that. So I think that that those tiny little marks actually carry a lot of cultural knowledge, I suppose, or kind of open up windows into everyday things that we don't really pay a lot of attention to. And Aldous didn't only shape the comma that we know today, he also invented the semicolon. Well, I guess he didn't really invent a new mark, as it were, but he pushed those two together, the colon and the comma, his comma, and kind of invented or created the hybrid sign, the semicolon. And this is interesting because whenever I ask people, what do you think the semicolon is? What kind of pause value does it have for you? People will say between a comma and a full stop, because we don't use the colon anymore very often, and we definitely use it in a different way from people in the Renaissance. That would, for instance, not use it necessarily for a list or something, but for two parts of sentence that are balanced against each other. But actually the semicolon is exactly that. It's half of a comma and half of a colon. So even less than a full stop. So it's a very subtle pause value, but that seemed to be necessary, at least for Pietro Bembo, the person for whom Aldous kind of invented it or printed it or had it cut in his De Etna, Bembo's De Etna. So I think that's a sort of a travelogue on climbing Mount Etna. He insists that he needs a more subtle pause, which is between the comma and the colon. So it sort of continues, the sentence continues, but it also doesn't. So it's less definitive, but also definitely more audible than a comma. So that was in 1494, I think, De Etna, which is also, by the way, the first use of the apostrophe. So there's even more. I forgot the apostrophe. So Aldous had, in this De Etna, he uses italics for the first time. He uses the semicolon for the first time. I'm not sure whether he uses the comma for the first time, but it's been around there too. So that, you know, that publication is really something in terms of punctuation. However, the semicolon didn't really catch on that fast. It took really around 100 years to be more established in English writing, at least. Although it did, I think, appear more often in manuscript than printed books. But it was definitely around by Shakespeare's time, Ben Jonson's time, 1590s. If you ask about the use of the semicolon today, I don't actually think it's very hard. I mean, the semicolon is more of a matter of taste, I would imagine. Because the way we use it today is exactly between a comma and a full stop. When we don't really want to end, but we also don't want to fully continue. So I think that the semicolon is really the example of punctuation defying rules and being a question of taste, and proudly so. I think I'm going to stop here and do two sections for this episode on part two, because I don't want to start a new part three because we're still in the Renaissance. There's so much to unravel. So I'm going to just finish here and do a new chunk where I speak about parentheses or brackets, ellipses, that's dot, 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 and what was the other one? Quotation marks. And then probably I can go up right until today. So see you for, or hear you for the second part of the second part of this shift punctuation.